Another week and another episode of the Feminist Podcast. The last week I was visiting London, one of my favorite cities in the world. To be honest, I used to live there for a bit, but it was also very interesting this time. I did not only have a great dinner at a couple of occasions, meet up with some old friends of mine, I also had the opportunity to visit JP Morgan's Asset Management, the Global Media Summit they arrange, where they actually look into trends and how portfolios will perform in the upcoming year. That was really intriguing. There were a few different trends that we discussed, and I want to dive into a couple of those in today's episode, because we discussed a few different facts about what's happening in the global stock market that we may not be aware of as Nordic investors. And together with me today, I've got Hugh Gimber, your global market strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management. Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me, and nice to have seen you in London last week.
You know, I picked up so many different things that I thought was really intriguing. One thing is that really I didn't explore or haven't thought that much about myself is in the Nordic region, for example, we have quite high mortgages. We've got, you know, high loans towards the real estate market. Hence, we haven't been able to save as much money here during the last years. But according to your data, if you look at emerging markets and if you look at China, for example, investors sit on large savings accounts. What do you think need to happen for the investors to regain trust in the stock market, would you say?
So this all really goes back to how China in particular has dealt with COVID over the past few years. So when we look across data across the world, you see a very similar pattern during 2020 and 2021 of consumers saving more than they typically would. Because at the time, lots of countries were dealing with COVID in different ways, but it's generally a fair assumption to say that broadly, restricted consumers found it more difficult to get out and spend, and therefore they were forced to save more typically. But what we've seen more recently is that the stock of savings in China has continued to go up, in part because, first of all, they pursued the zero COVID policy for much longer than we saw in many Western economies. But then also coming out of the pandemic, when that zero COVID policy was released, China's consumers have been much more reluctant to be spending that saving down. And China, importantly, it's a closed capital structure. So really, there are only three places that Chinese consumers can really put their money. Either you can park it in a bank account, or you can put it in the property market, or you can put it in the stock market. And when we look at each of those three things, we can see weakness in those different pockets. So with inflation very low in China, you're not being paid very much at all to save money in a bank account. The property market has been dealing with significant challenges, and the stock market has been coming under pressure as well. So it's perhaps in that context not surprising that the consumer pickup post-COVID in China has been much weaker than the reopening story that we've seen in many parts of the West.
But we've also seen the withdrawal of foreign investors that's been insecure in obviously the real estate market, similar to international investors have been pulling their money out of the Nordics for the very same reason. But then we've got the political aspect as well that is challenging. What do you think will happen? Like, what needs to happen or how will foreign investors return, or will they?
So I think they will over time, but they're looking for a reassurance, I think, from Chinese policymakers that they are ready to provide more support for the economy than they have so far. Because this isn't just about a sluggish growth backdrop linked to zero COVID. It's not just linked to the consumer. The real estate sector is really the big headwind facing the Chinese economy today. And this is a story of overcapacity. Investment that has chased that part of the market for too long and now is coming under real pressure. There's bad debt in parts of the system, which is really shaking domestic confidence, and it's also clearly shaking international investor confidence. So absolutely, as you say, we've seen a very steady withdrawal of money from foreign investors taking it out of the Chinese stock market that has coincided with a big decline in Chinese stock prices, and therefore that is the sort of almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see the market falling, therefore investors take out more money, as investors take out more money, you drive the market down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to your question, what do we need to see for investors to return? I think we need to see more comprehensive policy from the Chinese government to try and sort out the property sector. And that solution, I think, could look quite similar to what we saw in 2008 in the US, where eventually the government stepped in and said, we have bad debt in this system. We need to go around and sort of hoover up all of that bad debt and bring it onto the government balance sheet. We need to restore the faith of investors that you can look at the mortgage market again and trust that you know what you're buying, that you know who owns that debt, and really clean up the problem once and for all. And I think so far, China has been reluctant to do that, in part because of the moral hazard, in a way. You may have seen some of the headlines in recent months with Chinese developers like Evergrande or Country Garden, some of the high-profile names that have made the news in the West as, you know, problem companies effectively in the Chinese economy. And we think actually the mindset for the Chinese government has said, well, that's okay, because it's setting the precedent that you shouldn't try and take on too much debt, because you shouldn't just assume that we will bail you out at the first sign of problem. So there's that moral hazard where we know that a stronger resolution is required, and we think it will come over time. But so far, we've not seen that kind of response. In part, I think, because China is trying to set the tone for where they expect and how they expect companies to behave in the future.
Which is also an important responsibility for a government in those times. You're not going to be able to save everyone. If we look at what has happened, though, we got valuations are really low because investors have pulled out, both internationally, but also the investors in China, they put their money in the savings account. So valuations in the stock market are really look attractive from a historic perspective. But if we look at also the global exposure for emerging markets as an investment segment, China used to be 40% of emerging markets, and now it's like around 20% plus. Obviously, there is that political risk or opportunity, as you described just before. But how should one calculate that political risk to, like, is this really attractive, or is it another risk that could, you know, actually make this go even lower?
I think you make an absolutely critical point there, which is that, yes, there are macro headwinds facing the Chinese economy. Yes, there are political headwinds facing China as an investment opportunity, but equally that stock markets have moved to reflect a lot of that bad news. So we'd say that a lot of that negativity now is already reflected in Chinese stock prices. In terms of how we think about political risk, the way I always try and frame these types of debates is to say that politics matters for investors when it shifts the economic outlook. When it doesn't shift the economic outlook, it tends to be just noise. And so there are, you know, issues in China today with the way that they have approached some sectors, the technology sector, for example, in terms of trying to clamp down with new regulation, which has changed the earnings potential of some of these companies. And so the way that we would approach this now is really twofold. One, I think you have to assume that valuations will be lower in China than they have been in the past. So yesterday, we think that discount to developed markets is very, very wide, and that gap does have scope to close. But I wouldn't necessarily assume that returning to the valuations that we were at maybe 5 or 10 years ago is the right benchmark. I think you have to assume now that valuations, or multiples, as we would call them in China, will be lower as a result of the political risk. You can also think domestically within China, where are there sectors that are less exposed to some of these geopolitical trends? Where are there some really great companies with still good market share, but that maybe aren't caught up in some of these international conflicts in, say, the technology sector? And so turning more to the domestic outlook, trying to tap in to where those consumers in China might start to put some of their savings as confidence slowly returns over the next few quarters, I think is the right way to think about the Chinese market, and therefore being very selective in the types of companies that you're willing to pick out. There are more than 1,000 stocks to choose from in China. So not all of them clearly are bad companies. There have to be good opportunities within that market. But I think you need to be very selective and tapping into those more domestically focused names where policy risk is lower, I think is the right way to go about it.
And if we look globally, we've been moving slightly into the thought of emerging markets, and even to a broader extent, it's been suffering. And I think it's interesting to look at what countries are persistent and what countries are taking market share if we look at import export. So I would be intrigued to hear your thoughts about. Do we see any trends and any countries that actually take market share that would be interesting to look at?
We absolutely do. And I think probably the best example is Mexico out of the emerging market. So we have a chart in our Guide to the Markets pack that looks at the share of US imports that different countries are taking. And for the first time in more than 20 years, Mexico now has a larger share of US imports than China. Quite a big shift just in the past few years. We see China's share of US imports peaking out in around 2016. Which you'll recall is when the trade tensions really first started to escalate between the US and China. And so Mexico has been one major beneficiary. You'd also look within the other emerging markets at countries like Vietnam that appear well placed to be able to take market share. But you have to bear in mind that at an index level, some of these smaller countries are only a very small proportion of the emerging market stock index. So Vietnam, you can't swap out a Chinese stock market for a Vietnamese stock market and view them as like for like. So it tends to be the bigger chunks of the emerging market index, places like Mexico, that stand to be better positioned. And broadly, I'd say the opportunities in emerging markets outside of China are really twofold at the moment. There's first the benefits from these shifting trade links that we've described, so Mexico and Vietnam being two that are quite high up that list. The other is some of the AI beneficiaries that are still seeing really good tailwinds from lots of the excitement that we have in AI around the world, but at a far more reasonable valuation than you find in the US. So Korea and Taiwan would be two other emerging market countries outside of China where we'd call out very strong opportunities, albeit for a slightly different reason.
If we look at India, for example, the country has been having a really vast growing GDP and also population that is growing, that is, we know that China is struggling with. How would you say like the opportunity for India to continue to get a position there?
India is a really interesting one. I kind of think it's almost the complete opposite to China, where it has a much better macro tailwind. The stat I love about India is that if you look around the world, 20% of under 25s in the world live in India today. They have incredibly strong demographics, so loads and loads of macro tailwinds behind them over the coming years. But the problem is that lots of that optimism we think is very well reflected in stock market prices today. So a much more positive macro backdrop, but it's the valuation headwind, unlike somewhere like China, where the macro situation is more challenging, but you have a heavily discounted market. So there are still pockets of opportunity in India. We'd call out the banks as one area which is more reasonably valued, but still well positioned to tap into the rise of the consumer as people open their first bank account, take out their first insurance policy, as more of the transaction in India moves to digital currency. Lots of exciting trends, but I think you just have to be very careful with your starting point to make sure that you're not overpaying for some of those opportunities within the Indian market.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. It's a new generation of digitally native youngsters that actually start their first bank account. That's really a good what's happening in the world at the moment. What's going to happen? We don't know, of course, but what we do know is that just after this, we will go straight into an entrepreneur's interview together with my colleague Saba. So over to you, Saba. Thank you for being part of the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to our podcast. This week, we are fortunate to have with us two inspiring founders, sisters. Today with me, I do have Elisabeth and Annette Holtz. The sisters are the minds behind the Oh Yes Company, which is a Norwegian online store and distributor of healthy and delicious food, beauty and health products and lifestyle products. They say yes to products that are sustainable, that are good for you, that taste fantastic and have beautiful packaging, all without compromising. It's not the first time we have sisters in our podcast, but I promise you it's going to be a fun podcast today listening to them because they have such a roller coaster to talk about and such a nice story and inspiring journey. They have been through bankruptcy, they have been rebuilding the brand, and they have been doing a great job that we want to know more about. So welcome to this podcast, Elisabeth and Anat.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure talking to you.
And we're happy to hear more about you guys. So I want you to start with telling the listeners a little bit about your background, what you have been doing before, what you have been studying, and how you as sisters decided to become founders of Oh Yes.
Yes. Well, our backgrounds to begin with, we are two sisters. We grew up in Oslo and did, I would say, like the typical route of going to university, doing what we believed was smart, Anette in economics, myself in hospitality, and got ourselves our first corporate jobs. But somewhere along this ride, we both encountered each our story with some different health issues. We weren't feeling our best, and we couldn't get the help we needed from doctors. So what eventually helped was really just changing our diets, changing our lifestyles, really focusing on that. And that's what kind of got us interested into healthy foods, healthy lifestyle, how that can impact your quality in life. And I guess with going back to Anette and I, 5 years between us. So growing up, we weren't really that close.
No.
So I think that was also something that kind of in adulthood made us find each other and brought us closer in our 20s. So for years we were, you know, geeking out on healthy foods, making, you know, vegan and raw snacks in our kitchen and whatnot. But what we also found ourselves doing was every time we were traveling abroad, we'd fill up our suitcases with all the fun stuff, like all the good snacks from Whole Foods or, you know, wherever we were in the world. And then we came back to Norway and we just kept thinking, like, why isn't there a better offering and more variety of all these things in Norwegian health food shops or any shops?
One thing was the quality and the taste of the products. Then another thing was the packaging. It was so unsexy. You felt like it was really compromising your almost your style, I would say. Like, it's very like foot form alternative. It didn't represent your personality.
And meanwhile, we saw globally that there was this huge emerging market amongst wellness brands, and that it was more than possible to get a hold of things that not only were healthy and sustainable, but also felt like a first choice when it came to either it be taste and quality or just the feeling of picking up a luxurious brand with nice packaging. So yeah, that's what sparked the idea of, right, we need to do something about this in Norway.
Yeah, but Anette, you were working with something totally different, or were you in the same field at that time?
At that time, I was working for one of the, well, at that time, startup in Norway called Kolonihagen, which is really focusing, or its total ethos is built on organic produce. So I got a bit like the feeling of how you're a small startup family, a lot of different hats there as well, even though my focus was marketing and graphic design. But you got the sense of how it is to start up a company. And as well, I got to work with what was my passion, and that was clean food.
So you kind of had this with you when you were trying to find a solution for the problem that you defined as sisters.
Yeah, well, it was a beginning because you had clean approach to food, but it wasn't, I don't know how to put it in the right way, but it wasn't, it's not enough that it's clean, because you still can have like a burden of sugar, for instance. Or so I was always called, even though you work in a total organic company, I was always like the alternative or the bit crazy one who was like, yeah, no dairy, no gluten, no nothing. So I was taking it even a step further than the clean organic produce approach.
I think we've both been known as the ones taking it a little far in our workplaces. I remember when I worked in Nordic Choice Hotels a while back, I went for summer holiday. And when I came back, one of my colleagues had put like alfalfa seeds in my laptop keyboard. So when I came home back to work, I had sprouts coming out of my keyboard.
No! Oh, that's funny. So back to the foundation of, oh, yes, when did you come up with the idea and how did you manage to do the, like the first phase? I know you said something about like, you know, the end of 2017 and it was probably not really there yet, but there was a kind of like surge in demand of, and a demand for sustainable products, but also like, you know, as you said, the things that look and taste lovely. And not only just like, you know, taste lovely, but like it could be lovely, healthy, and look nice and attractive. How did you start?
Yeah, so like you said, something was happening in the market. And as the story goes, we'd been talking about this for a couple of years and we had some crazy ideas. At one point, we were going to bring coconut yogurt to Norway because we always ate coconut yogurt when we were in London. And then we realized the burden of working with chilled foods was just too heavy. So we were like, no, we're not going to work with yogurt. So I'm glad we kind of just threw that in the bin quite quickly. But then kind of spontaneously, Anette had been in Sweden, actually, at the Saluhall in Gothenburg. And she found this chocolate brand called Gudjo. It was Finnish and they had this vegan, raw, sweetened with coconut blossom sugar, kind of healthy bean to bar chocolate that also had like this beautiful packaging. And she grabbed it with her and came home and she tried it and she was just like, oh my god, this also like tastes really delicious.
Because I really only like picked it up from the store because the packaging was so beautiful. I would never imagine that it would like tick my personal boxes. So it was just from the beautiful packaging. But when I turned it over and started reading, it's like, oh, vegan, raw, no refined sugars. It was like, how is this possible?
Yeah. And then we were like, right, we need to do something about this. So I fired away an email to the producer saying, hi, we're a Norwegian distributor. We would love to sell your chocolate in Norway. And at that point, we had nothing. We didn't even, I think we'd just come up with the name for the company, oh yes. But other than that, we didn't even have a website. And they answered immediately, said, wow, this is great. It's a Norwegian distributor. How about you come to Helsinki and meet with us? And so we flew off to Helsinki 2 weeks later. And before that, we just had to scramble together a logo and a website and some sort of presentation that made it look like we knew what we were doing.
I love that.
And we went
to tickets.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's how like all women should do it all the time, like, you know, because we know that guys would do that in a second, but we need to like, you know, kind of reassure ourselves that we know that we can do it. We only need to fake it a little bit in the beginning.
What's the worst? It's better to regret something you did than you didn't do, because then unless you will never know. So
I mean,
just give it a go.
The worst consequence of that could have been a no, like literally. Yeah.
And but maybe it doesn't sound like it was a no, so no, tell us more.
So we were pretty confident because it was a space we knew so well from a personal, and I think that's, you know, an important part of the story, that we could really like come from the footsteps of the actual customer we're trying to like our target audience. But I had also worked in sales for many years, so I was pretty confident in that regard, that I was like, oh my god, how hard can it be? How hard can it be getting some products into a store when they're so good? Like, that's, you know, piece of cake. And a little naive with regards to like the supermarket chains and everything here in Norway, but that's a long story. But we went to Helsinki and we did our little pitch and they were like, oh my god, you have such a great overview of the market, and wow, you really know what you're talking about. And luckily for us as well, they were a very ethos-based company. So for them, the first sort of test was for a distributor to work with them, the distributor had to find them and be interested in them rather than them going out and, you know, pitching themselves to others. So we kind of already passed the first test by reaching out to them directly. And we just agreed that, yeah, let's go. Let's just launch in Norway in 2 weeks. And so we scrambled together 20,000 Norwegian kroners. That was our starting capital. We didn't even have an AS.
AB.
Just Enkeltmannsföretag. And we took these 20,000 kroners of our personal money, invested that in like a first stock, which was maybe, you know, 5 boxes of every flavor of that particular chocolate. And then we went to like the 5 lowest hanging stores we could think of, something that would be similar to maybe like Paradisa or Urban Deli or something like that in Stockholm, and basically just brought them some samples and gave them a pricing and got them to buy the product. So 2 weeks later, we were out in the market. We launched with 5 stores through a little PR launch party where we invited some influencers and made some cocktails that we paired with chocolates. And yeah, that was that. We were...
then you were distributors, officially.
Part of this story is that at that time, I was 7 or 8 months pregnant. So part of the plan was also that come February, March, which was a few months later, I was going into maternity leave. So we saw that this as a window of opportunity for us to really get the company going without having to kind of take out a huge salary, but, you know, have something to do when, you know, we were obviously going to have a baby that was going to sleep all the time and be super easy and no stress.
So you were basically pregnant, working 100%.
Yeah. So I was pregnant, working 100% for Nordic Choice Hotels. And then in our spare time, we were running around between stores and knocking on doors and getting the chocolates out.
So your son's nursery was basically ours, where our stock was.
Yeah. So before we had a warehouse, it was literally the cupboard of his nursery. That's where all the chocolate was.
Loved it.
Yeah. I was also literally, well, I was actually doing my graphic design education at that time. We're finishing that, but I was still working 80% for Kolonihagen as well. So I was working 180% on top of starting the company as well.
Yeah.
And then you kept taking in new products and distributing new products, or did you like keep on the chocolate for some time ahead?
We worked solely with the chocolate for just a few months, really, and grew that base of 5 retailers to maybe 30, 40, I can't remember, but quite a few. But we realized in order to both get the revenues we need, but also make ourselves more attractive to more retailers, we need to have a portfolio so that they see us as more of a like one-stop shop supplier. Any retailer wants to have as few suppliers as possible because, you know, things take time. And yeah, one thing led to the next. And then we got in a couple of new brands. And then eventually in the Nordics, the environment for organic foods is really small. So all the small producers between Finland and Sweden and Denmark, they talk to each other. So word got out eventually that, you know, there's this small company in Norway. They're doing quite well. They have a little bit of a different approach. They're a little more young and fresh and without compromise than the sort of old health food dinosaurs, so to speak. And then brands started contacting us. So our portfolio in the first year grew from 1 to maybe 7 brands. And during that year, whilst I was in maternity leave, I had one job, and that was when the baby was sleeping, I was selling. So it went from 5 to 50 independent retailers quite quickly. And then 4 days after I gave birth, Sunkost, which is the biggest health food chain in Norway, they're slightly bigger than Life, which you know in Sweden, invited us to come in and present portfolio. And we were just like, right, we can't miss this opportunity. So my husband had the little baby in the stroller, like outside Sunkost main office, just super stressed out, just walking back and forth. And we were in there taking a meeting with Sunkost that ended up taking in a handful of the products that we sold. So that was the first sort of big deal. And then eventually we also started working with Life, with Espresso House, a few other smaller chains here and there. Yeah.
And as teasing about in the beginning of this podcast, you went through kind of roller coaster with, you want to share some background about that and some learning? So for us to listen to other entrepreneurs that could like learn from your experience in that regard.
Absolutely. Well, you already mentioned that we went through a bankruptcy after starting the company bootstrapping with, like we said, 20,000 knots, to some extent are able to build brick for brick. But it takes money to make money. So you need capital to grow. So when you grow too fast without really any capital, it can be expensive to be poor. So we were able to, I think we turned over when we were at the most, we turned over 7 million knots.
Yeah. So in the first 2 years, without any working capital, we somehow managed to bootstrap ourselves from 0 to 7 million knots.
And along the way, we all as a startup, you always make costly mistakes. So we had some cash flow, but which made us able to continue running, but not really being profitable.
First of all, like we mentioned, we started only with 20,000 NOK, which is obviously nothing. And somehow, miraculously, in the first couple of years, we managed to bootstrap ourselves from 0 to 7 million Norwegian kroners in turnaround. And because we had this revenue and this cash flow going, we kind of managed to operate, but our cash flow was awful. We were always late with payments. There was no buffer, there was no marketing budget, no room for making any mistakes with how we spent our money. Nevertheless, as entrepreneurs, you always have all these ideas. You're not always as good at thinking that, like throwing away the ones that aren't great. So we'd attend events and have pop-ups and do like all these things that we thought were gonna give us a lot in return, but without really breaking down the costs of it properly in advance. So we were doing a lot of like things that weren't really cool, thinking it was a good maybe marketing opportunity or something, but really just spending more money than we really could afford.
Basically like events and pop-ups and things that really didn't give you any conversion or any sales.
Oh, so yeah. It didn't like at least directly give us revenue in return, and probably not the marketing we needed either. And given that we had such poor cash flow, we weren't in a position where we could really spend money on marketing that we didn't know got like. I mean, we should have just focused all our time on sales, like direct sales, really.
With only two resources being ourselves, one of the biggest learnings we've done is that it's so important not to lose focus on your core operations, because you think you can do everything and you can do a lot. But if you lose focus where the real revenue comes from, then you're a bit lost.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at that time you didn't have a mentor or an investor in that regard, of course, that could be kind of like, you know, sharing insight and more.
Exactly. So that's also an important learning. It's really easy when it's just the two of us. You know, we're so well aligned as well that sometimes you just don't feel like you need someone else because we have each other. You're so focused on what you're doing. So you end up just kind of staying in that side with a little bit of a tunnel vision without seeking more of a community. And like you mentioned, mentorship. So we had a few things we did. We also at one point got a showroom that we thought was a very good idea. And we were just going to do a tiny bit of paint job, but ended up spending way too much money on refurbishing and making it nice without really sitting down and breaking down the numbers as to how is this going to give us more revenue. So really, like as entrepreneurs, you just need to be really careful with how you spend your money. But when I think of it, you know, looking back now, I think those lessons, considering that this was while we were bootstrapping, has really taught us how to be very mindful about managing our money. Because I have heard and I believe that if you raise a lot of capital from like pre-seed, etc., you can become a little bit, I don't know if it's right to say fat and happy, but because you have a lot of money on your bank account, it can be easy to just spend because you believe that you have this runway going. But yeah, it's worth mentioning in the middle of all this that we had just refurbished this showroom, and then 2 weeks later, COVID hit. And we, at that point, we were solely a B2B retailer. So we were very dependent on physical shops being open. So, you know, put two and two together and 70% of our revenue basically disappeared overnight. Luckily, after a short while, the health food chains were allowed to open again. So that kind of saved us a bit, but still that just made things even more difficult. And I think from difficult times, there can come a lot of good ideas and a lot of innovation. And that's when we also launched a web shop. But the problem was that when we launched this web shop, we still had no working capital. So we have no money to put into digital marketing. We have no money to put into a larger inventory or any of the things that would have rigged us for actually capitalizing on what a lot of other e-commerce businesses did during the pandemic. So it wasn't really that much help. It just gave us double workload without really generating any revenue. And that's kind of caused us to give ourselves another revenue by opening physical pop-up shops without thinking about not only the cost of it, but how much time and focus it stole for us. So all of these things and that we were trying out accumulated. Cash flow wasn't getting any better. One thing led to another, and come 2023, it just wasn't sustainable anymore. So what happened then was that we ended up filing for bankruptcy with the first company, but we were still, and that was also having tried fundraising and trying to kind of piece things together, but also being meeting a lot of investors that were like, you are on the right track, you are on a mega trend, you're doing such a great job. And at this point, we'd have had two babies each. So we were doing this while, you know, doing the whole maternity thing and everything. Yeah. But we are not going to invest in your accumulated supplier debt. Your balance is completely off and it's too risky. The markets are not great. E-commerce is not doing very well, etc., etc. But again, you know, we had this very strong feeling confirmed by looking at the market and what we were being told, that we are onto something and we are doing something right. We've just never had enough working capital. We've made a lot of silly mistakes and tried a lot of things that didn't work out without having any financial room to actually do that.
Yeah.
So we spoke to our suppliers. We spoke to, eventually we went bankrupt, but the first thing we did were like, no, we can't sell off, just let someone buy the bankruptcy estate, like buy a web shop for cheap. It's just not right because there's so much work and integrity into this. We've spent a lot of time developing what we call OES Clean Standard, which is kind of what sets us apart in many ways in a very kind of messy landscape of what's healthy, what's not, etc. And luckily, one of these investors called Digital Insight that we'd been working towards for a while, they were like, if you're going to start up again, we want to help you, we want to invest a little bit. But because this is a new company, we need to do it on a low pricing. And then another friend of ours who's very into health, she's like an ultra marathon runner, also had the opportunity to come in. So we started up again now in March 2023. We got all the previous suppliers on board. We got new agreements with all the retailers we already work with, because the problem wasn't that our products weren't selling or that no one wanted to work with us. It was really just that we weren't able to operate efficiently. We weren't able to deliver according to demand. We were always out of stock and, you know, stuff that just wasn't sustainable. So we negotiated a price to buy back our inventory, buy back our everything from the bankruptcy estate, and then cleaned away the brands that we knew weren't working and really just tidied up everything to create like a really tight, very, very lean business model, really dug into our cash flow budgets and everything just to kind of identify where do we need to be profitable? What is our vision? What is our core operation? What can we do to just go in this direction without straying anymore?
Lovely. Amazing. So many learnings and lessons to take with you. So now you have these two investors, or the friend and the investor who's actually investing in the company. What is the, we've been talking about, like, you know, the background and the story. What are your strategies and visions for 2024 and 5 years ahead? What are you looking for at the moment?
Well, after starting up the company again, and as Elizabeth said, looking into what is our core, really, what we found is that, and what we had bringing into the new company as well, were two sales channels, B2B and B2C. So we need to strengthen them. And so really our main goal now, coming 2024, is to create our own products. Because now we have the sales channels established, so we can create our own brands and quickly bring them to market. And with those three aspects, then we can own the whole supplier chain, really.
So our main focus now is just continuing to work towards kind of vertical integration of the value chain. And by owning our own products and creating our own product, not only do we own more of the value chain, we get more margins, we become more profitable, but come one day we might look for an exit, it also makes us a lot more valuable and unique as a company. So right now we're sort of in the middle of, we've spent a year just kind of solidifying our sales channels, scaling up marketing, working in the web shop a little bit just to get to a certain point, but we still see that the demand for what we're selling is slightly higher than what we're actually able to deliver. So we're now in the middle of trying to complete, I would say, a fairly small bridge round of capital in order to both sort of solidify this and ensure that we are actually delivering according to the demand that is there already. But like Annette said, we're going to start investing in our own product and pivot to a larger degree towards, like, every time we learn that a category is very successful, we look into, okay, but is there anything missing here? Is there anything we can create ourselves? How can that be done in the same uncompromising way that we've already been working with existing brands? So we're onto a couple of tracks here. I can't talk too much about one of them, but the other one is a partnership starting with a Norwegian company called Aker Biomarine, where we're working on developing a supplement brand towards women, focusing on cellular health, whereas the other one's more in the sort of health foods space. And another thing we've also noticed with our web shop is that our customers keep coming back. Like 90% of all the stuff we sell, you know, it's all consumer goods, so it can be repurchased, and some of it's very good, so it's very addictive. So we see that the same customers, either it's their favorite bar, they buy a whole box, they buy the same flavor, and they buy like 3 boxes at the time, and they come back every month for the same box, or they buy 6 tubes of their favorite toothpaste because they're afraid of running out. So we believe there's a space for creating a smart subscription offering on a website. So that's also something we'll, so there are like 2 tracks we're on. One is product development and eventually launching more of our own products. And then the next one is starting to work on an MVP for this subscription stack, but with the goal of creating the most sort of comprehensive and flexible wellness consumer goods subscription solution direct to consumer here in Norway.
Lovely. Yeah, that's interesting. So you have a lot to look forward to this year and the coming year, I guess. If there is someone who wants to get in touch with you, how do we do that?
Well, you can email us at what's the best email to use? hi@oes.no, H-E-I, which is the Norwegian way of saying hi, @oes.no, or just fill out the contact form on oes.no. You can find us on Instagram, on OES Oslo,
or LinkedIn.
Or LinkedIn, or Facebook, and, you know, wherever you DM us, we will reply. You can find us personally on LinkedIn, we will reply there as well. So,
and you're open for investors, partners, and other creative ideas, I guess, and consumers.
Absolutely. And at the moment, it's worth mentioning that, like I said, we're working on keeping as lean a business model as possible. So it's still just us as the employees of the company. That might change in the future, obviously. But we believe that, you know, looking for consultants, partners, anyone that can contribute into the company and create like a stack of superheroes that can help us succeed. We might be looking for a couple of advisors and maybe some more. We only have one other board member, so we're also, you know, looking at how can we build the most interesting and helpful board in order to achieve all these goals. So yeah, we're just open for any connection, anyone that believe they have something to say or contribute with in the wellness consumer e-commerce or distribution space is very useful. And we keep like circling back to this, trying to never forget how important seeking external advice, building community is, because it is easy to get stuck in our day-to-day and our bubble when there's so much to do.
Definitely, yeah. And I'm so happy that you're part of Expam Network in Norway, and like, you know, getting to learn more about you, but also like, you know, introduce you to our network of entrepreneurs and mentors and senior women that could be beneficial in different ways. And I hope to see you in Oslo on our Fearless event, which is on the 25th of April, and that people will be able to meet you, and maybe some of your customers will be able to, or you will actually be able to find new customers there as well at the event. So I am really thankful for this episode and all the learnings and all the exciting things that you have ahead. And I look forward to follow your journey, but also meeting you in Oslo on the 25th of April.
Looking forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.